Luckily for you, the answer to the great question of life, the universe and everything is to be found in this podcast, A Worker's Guide to Everything. Sometimes cans, often bad language, always solid politics. This is the Trademark Belfast podcast. Listen out for Trademark regulars and very special comrade guests and fellow travellers talking all things lefty, Ireland and the world. We remain, as always, anti-sectarian, anti-racist and anti-fascist. Enjoy. Buenas tardes. Hello and welcome once again to another Trademark podcast. I'm joined again today by regular contributors Stuart McGill, Sean Byers, and today we're here today to talk about something that, unless you've had your head firmly shoved up your ass for the last couple of years, you'll have noticed it, which is, of course, the arms trade and the arms race, really, in the arms trade and the growing militarism and conflict around the world. And we wanted to talk a little bit about that. It's kind of got a little bit feverish recently, the arms race, and it's been spearheaded, of course, per usual, by Western imperialism. But also the global trade cuts across most power blocks and regions, and everyone, it seems, is at it. Even in Europe, I think there was a quote there, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has declared the war in Ukraine a turning point, and Germany's up their military spending to 100 billion. Macron has doubled French military spending since he came to power in 2017. United States, as we know, no expense spared there in funding the military-industrial complex. You know, hundreds of billions, if not a trillion. I don't know what the latest figures are on what the US spends on arms. I'm sure we'll find out shortly. So, lads, we'll kick off with that kind of broad question, if you don't mind. And that's the idea of the size of this industry. Give us an insight into how big this industry is, Stuart. Who are the biggest exporters of arms?
Right. In terms of size, looking at some figures a couple of years ago from Oxfam, very useful research they did, you always have to remember this is an industry which lives in the shadows. So many of these figures are dubious, but they just give an indication. Oxfam reckoned that an estimated $112 billion was spent on arms imports between 2018 and 22. So that's actually people buying arms from other countries. The top five guys are America, Russia, France, China, and Germany. Now, some of the figures we might talk about later don't include Russia and China because it's difficult to actually estimate how much they do spend. But those top five account for over three quarters of the global arms trade. And they sold an estimated $85 billion worth of arms annually across that period. So that gives you some indication of how big the industry is. We'll talk later about how important it actually is for economies.
Yeah, I'm quite surprised to hear Germany in the top five. Is that a recent thing, or have they always been up there over the last sort of 20, 30 years?
I've always been a big manufacturing power. And as even my father admitted, who won World War II single-handed, though he admitted that he did it with the help of Comrade Stalin, German ordnance, German weaponry was and is actually very good. So just on the basis of quality, they will always sell stuff. Always a pretty important arms producer.
Yeah, Sean, in that terms, where does kind of Europe more broadly then fit into the arms trade? I mean, obviously Germany's in there as the biggest manufacturer, as Stuart said, in Europe, so it's bound to make a big contribution. But it's not just the arms trade, is it? It's that idea of increasing militarization of Europe and other regions around the globe. So there's a political dynamic behind the arms trade, isn't it? I know it's a two-way street, but it's a growth in militarism as well that's driving the arms trade, isn't it?
Yeah, and geopolitics factors into it, obviously, as well. Like, I mean, you look at the case of France, what I noticed, France has recently jumped ahead of Russia in terms of levels of arms exports. And the primary reason for that, as far as I understand, although Stuart might correct me if I'm wrong, is that the likes of Egypt were pressurized to cut ties with Russia and to buy French arms instead. So you have these geopolitical games playing. And in terms of Europe as a whole, now we know the EU was never a peace project. It was a Cold War creation, designed to counter the power of the Soviet Union. And it's never promoted peace. But if you set that aside and you even look at most more recent decades, the EU has been gradually pursuing an increasingly militarized path since at least the Lisbon Treaty. And that provided a legal basis for a common European defense and security policy. So since then, military spending has increased in line with the demands of like PESCO, Permanent Structured Cooperation, which Ireland has now joined, European imperialism's involvement with wars in the Middle East, And then the movement of refugees, which saw increased investment in the brutality of Fortress Europe. But there's been a real escalation in the past couple of years, particularly with the onset of the war in Ukraine and Europe, or the European core, hitching its fortunes to those of the US empire and its geopolitical power games. And that Egypt-France dynamic is one aspect of that. So what we're seeing is like unhinged pro-war rhetoric of the European political establishment, like talking up the prospect of confrontation with Russia and China, accompanied by increasing commitments to military spending, like particularly in NATO countries. So the combined military expenditure for Europe now, if you include Britain, is now higher than China's and about four times more than Russia's. So you tell me who the aggressor is.
Yeah. I'm just for all our liberal listeners, I can't believe Sean's just slagged off the European Union as not being a peace project. I mean, it did win the Nobel Peace Prize, Sean, in 2012. I want you to remember that. So, I mean, it wouldn't have won that unless, of course, it was a huge peace project. But no, the link, and you're rightly to point out the link between, of course, you know, militarism, the growth in militarism, and the arms trade. Those two go hand in hand. One reinforces the other. What Sean mentioned out there about the geopolitical dimension of this and the idea that, for instance, France's exports to Egypt have increased because Egypt's been, you know, encouraged to cut ties with Russia. But who are we exporting to? Like, who are the biggest importers of all these weapons and armaments from the top five or six or seven? Which, of course, I thought Britain's up there, I think, number six or seven. But and what do those big importers tell us about the geopolitical conflicts in those regions?
Well, if I can just shamelessly plug my forthcoming article in the International Magazine, in which we cover a lot of this stuff. The interesting thing for me doing the research on this, and I kind of knew this, but I wasn't aware how big it was. India is the major arms importer. India imports about 9.8, maybe 10% of imported arms between 2019 and 2023. Again, as Sean talked about, a bit of a function of the need to diversify away from Russia, because there were pressure put, don't buy so many from, because I think that this conflict with Russia has been planned for some time by the United States. Again, apologies to any liberal listeners there, but this is a proxy war the United States has been aiming at for some time. So people are probably advised, don't buy your arms from those naughty Russian people. And the interesting thing about Indian arms, and again, this is all in the article, a large part of these arms are supplied by Israel, who has a very close relationship with India and also has a very close relationship with the United States arms industry. It's best to see them as two cheeks of the same imperialist arse. When you look down here as well, Saudi Arabia, 8.4% of the imported arms, Qatar, 7.6%. Now, they're two really quite tiny economies in the scheme of things, so, and quite tiny populations. So their arms imports per capita are fucking insane. They don't really need most of these arms either. This is a function of something we'll talk about later, I'm sure, the bribery and payoff culture in the industry. Ukraine got up to 4.9%. Ukraine, again, been looking to wage war for a long time. I could go on, but people can read the article.
What about, I read your article there last night, mate. Very good as usual. And Australia's is one of the big five or six top arms porters. I mean, Australia, is that just a function of the extension of US imperialism and the coming, like, not war with China, but that whole tension with China, Taiwan and the rest of it?
Yeah, Australians are vaguely obsessed about the Chinese sweeping down upon them. And they do have a pretty well-developed special forces and a military tradition. Older listeners might remember the efforts the Australians made in the Vietnam War in the 1960s. And a significant part of that was actually Australian special forces, who were mostly Brits, that were sent to help out the American effort across there. Had a very serious casualty rate across there. And they were supplied by Brits because it was Harold Wilson's way of saying to the Americans, look, we're helping you out here. But yeah, it's a country with a martial tradition and a great deal of paranoia. And of course, many tin pot countries like that, most of the arms be used against their own people or to turn back refugees.
Yeah, thanks for that. I'm sure you wanted to come in there just and add a bit on Europe.
Yeah, I just wanted to add that because what Stuart was talking about brought a few things to mind. So it's really just looking at who's benefiting from the increase in militarization of Europe and the logic behind it, you know, aside from ideology and geopolitics, right? So the US defense industry has benefited massively from the increase in militarization of Europe. It increased its overall weapons exports by 20% in the last 4 years, and most of that went into Europe. And one of the things happening in Ukraine in particular has provided US arms companies with a dumping ground for surplus and obsolete equipment. A lot of the stuff they send there is absolute shite. You know, it's referred to as trash by people within the military establishment. But the European defense industry has also benefited enormously. Like, so the stock prices of the European biggest European companies has risen between 100% and 400% since 2022. So going forward, I think, like, you know, we look at the way things are heading, we could be looking at a major expansion of Europe's own military industrial complex, partly as a way of offsetting the decline of the core industries. Like, so you have the European Defence Fund, you have the European Defence Investment Plan, European Defence Industrial Strategy. You have Germany and France proposing that the European Investment Bank be allowed to invest in security and defence. You have France and several others calling for the EU to issue joint debt for increased military spending. And of course, as we know, military spending is one of the exemptions for the new and
fiscal rules.
Like, so war and the talk of war is good for business.
And of course, of the $60 billion that the United States has promised through Ukraine, about 50% of that will never leave the United States. This is just a direct transfer from, you know, the US Treasury direct to the military industrial complex's profits for American arms companies. It will never reach Ukraine, I suppose. But I wanted to ask another question, which is this idea also then of the domestic contribution of arms production. Because you hear quite a lot, and I belong to a union that has quite a few members in the arms trade in Britain and indeed here in the north of Ireland. And so I wanted to ask you, how important is the arms trade to, like, the British, European, or even the United States domestic economy? Because we're told, oh, they're big employers and you can't stop arms production because thousands of people will be on the dole, blah, blah, blah. So what's the score there, Stuart? Are there any interesting facts about the domestic contribution of the arms trade?
Yeah, there are. This is one of the great confidence tricks perpetrated on people through fucking history. And Sean was talking there about the saying we need to spend all this money and it's a way of actually rescuing European industry. It's actually not. There are much better ways of spending the money. Britain recorded 8.5 billion arms exports in 2022, which was a record, yeah? 1% of total exports, 2.05% of total exports of goods. Arms account for around 0.2%, rounding up, of all UK jobs. And even when you look at manufacturing...
And again, 0.2%.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. This idea, I mean, we are a big economy. We sell an awful lot of stuff. To a certain extent, it's because the arms are expensive. There has been a big increase in the amount of expenditure in arms by various countries over the years. But this is a productivity increase indicated by the fact that they spend so much fucking money. But it doesn't generate that much dosh, nor that much employment. The dosh will go into the pockets of the wealthy people who invest in the big armaments companies, BlackRock, etc., the usual. So it's 0.2% of total jobs. And it's, I think, with manufacturing, there's about 2.5 million people employed in manufacturing, broadly defined in the UK. UK armaments account for around 3.2% of that employment. So this is nothing like as important that is. And we'll go ahead and talk later on about subsidies. But when you look at British Aerospace, they paid just 14% of their R&D costs over the last couple of years because the government subsidizes all that shit. When you look in the States, now, again, employment in the working sector has dropped dramatically over the last 40 years. It was 3.5 million Americans in the mid-80s, about 1 million today employed directly in the weapons sector. Now, these are figures compiled by the National Defense Industrial Association, so not some bunch of pinkos or commies. Those 1 million jobs represent 0.6% of the jobs of the US civilian labor force. So it's an important industry and it's very important in certain areas. The lobby in the States is very, very clever at spreading, basically spread arms across a wide number of constituencies. And we'll talk maybe later on about something I go on about in the article, the military metaphysic, which C. Wright Mills talked about in the late 50s and early 60s. People get turned on by all this military bullshit. They use paranoia and they use the obsession with the whole tough guy thing to make it seem like military expenditure is necessary. And you get this on the left too. You get the Soviet Union portrayed of the parade of missiles. And I must confess, every time the winter turns up, I'm delighted because I can put on my parka and balaclava and patrol the mean streets of Blackheath here. There is this aesthetic about military stuff, which people get turned on by.
Yeah, we've noticed it massively in the last 6 months in Ireland, haven't we, Sean? The whole NAFO crowd, the North Atlantic fellow organization types on Twitter and on social media, who there's been a huge push for increased militarization, increased military spending in Ireland, above and beyond even what's demanded under the PESCO contributors, hasn't it, Sean? It's a real push in Ireland for that. But there's two questions there. One is that push, as Stuart said, that kind of militaristic metaphysic, the idea that we want to be part of this big club of aggressive militarism versus its actual contribution to anyone's domestic economy.
Yeah, and that's
in terms of actual good jobs, like.
Yeah, and you're right. You know, that's that propaganda in Ireland's going into overdrive. Thankfully, it hasn't worked. To date, you know, the majority of people are still in favour of a strong policy of Irish neutrality, but it hasn't stopped them from trying, and they tried every trick in the book. They're even on the Russian interference now, I see in the Irish Times. But yeah, like, part of the argument we need to get better at making, and the evidence supports this, is that from a social and economic perspective, you know, aside from the humanity and the moral side of it, the resources invested in the defence industry would be much better deployed elsewhere. Right, so there's loads of research that supports this. The Rand Corporation, for example, here's a couple of examples. The Rand Corporation published research that finds that prioritizing infrastructure investment would make a bigger contribution to long-term economic growth and stability, whilst also reducing the environmental footprint. And we'll talk about that a bit later. Brown University has compared the employment impact of military expenditure with other sectors, and they found that the same amount of spending creates 50% more jobs in clean energy and healthcare, and twice as many jobs in education, for the simple reason that these jobs are just more labour intensive, or these sectors are more labour intensive. So the sectors that are necessary for decent living conditions, for social cohesion, for a livable planet, are also the ones that generate more and better employment. You know, it's a trade union argument, and it's one that could and should be made better within our movement.
No, 100%. It's back to peace, love and democracy and swords into plowshares, isn't it, for us? We seem to have lost that language and lost that kind of direction in terms of that's what we used to stand for, peace and socialism. That used to be what being a socialist meant, that you didn't want to engage and send your kids off to fight in pointless fucking bloody imperialist wars. Thanks for that contribution, Sean. I want to move on to another thing we've mentioned already, and we wanted to talk a little bit, and that's about the political lobbying and the power of lobbying groups. I know that you mentioned, Sean, about the massive increase in militarism in Europe recently. I know that the Aerospace Security and Defence Industries Association, ASD, is a huge lobby within the European Union. And in fact, as you said, up until the Lisbon Treaty, the EU was kind of barred, wasn't it, from using its actual budget to fund military activity. So then Juncker, our man, you know, Jean-Claude Juncker, they found a workaround because they initially made defence part of EU's industrial strategy, which meant you could invest in the industrial strategy and then by extension, you invested in the military. But that was pushed massively by the ASD, by this arms and defence lobbying group. And it's a huge issue, isn't it, Stu? I'll come to you first, Stu. I'll come back to you, Sean, about if you've got anything to say on that. In America, in the US, sorry, Stu, it's a huge issue, isn't it? The lobbying from the arms industry.
My God, it's massive. There's no doubt about it.
And the second question, sorry, and how they actually, sorry, and this is the sort of second question, how they actually promote war. You know, that means part of their strategy. It's not just for the production of arms. It's also the promotion of conflict, of course.
Well, there's a shared interest with them and politicians in feeding paranoia. There's a decent series on Netflix now about the Cold War. And it's interesting that Daniel Ellsberg, the late great Daniel Ellsberg, is on there. And he says that original spy planes showed that the Soviet Union did not have 4,000 missiles that could hit America. But they had four. But it became very clear with the spy planes that the Soviet Union was not any sort of real threat to the United States whatsoever and didn't regard itself as a threat. But they didn't actually dial down the tension, because a little bit of national unity, a little bit of paranoia can come from the idea of an external enemy. And also it was going to affect some jobs and the various strong people in the lobby. But when you look at how much they've spent on the lobby, the number of senators that have an intimate relationship with the arms industry, and the revolving door, not just in America, but here as well, between government and the arms industry. John Major, maybe some would say the last Tory prime minister who wasn't a complete knobhead, though there's a debate to be had about that. John Major got a job in the arms industry afterwards. This is what these guys do. British Aerospace has an extremely close relationship with the government and has done for a long time. Okay, I talk about this in the article. Tony Blair actually sent, whenever Aerospace was being investigated by the Serious Fraud Office, Tony Blair sent a message to the Attorney General saying, you really want to go ahead and do this? Margaret Beckett, who was then the kind of left-leaning left-leaning New Labour foreign secretary, she told her officials to tell the SFO, Serious Fraud Office, British Aerospace and the Saudi Arabians are very pissed off about this. They are very successful at making governments and people in positions of power identify their interest and the country's interest with that of the arms industry. Yeah. And that's a major problem. And you see, again, something I put in the article about Germany, a huge increase in lobbying. What was it? Yeah. The arms industry doubled its expenditure in the EU between 2012 and 2017. And they've been successful because they're going to spend a lot more, like Sean says.
Yeah, yeah. The proof's in the pudding, as I say. Sean, what about that? Is it an exaggeration to say that the arms trade and the arms lobby groups are promoting conflict or promoting war? Or is it just an extension of an arms race that eventually conflict's going to happen somewhere? Or do you think there's more to it than that?
Well, it seems to me that there's at least an attempt to promote the supply of arms, right, into regions that are vulnerable to conflict, whether that's over conflict or resources or unstable governments or whatever may be the case. And most of those regions are in the global south. But there's like really blatant examples of how they go about this. I don't know how I didn't know about this before. This is one example at a national level in Britain where they set up a defence and security exports unit, which works with the industry to promote the sale of weapons and military equipment to a whole host of repressive regimes and the countries in conflict. That's their target market, right? So this is just one of the ways in which imperialism hasn't really changed its spots. You know, you go back 200 years, the imperial core dumps its weapons into countries of the global south whilst appropriating their labor and resources. Like, it's, you know, it's a carbon copy of that situation. It's continuing.
Yeah, so, and it's interesting, isn't it, about the closeness of the state to the arms industry, which is kind of what you pointed out. The idea of set up this body precisely to do that, precisely to flood arms into areas that are already, you know, as you said, vulnerable to conflict or actually engaged in conflict. And there's a real, you know, it's like state monopoly capitalism, isn't it, Stuart? This idea of the closeness between the state and arms companies. And I know that we know that corporate welfare underpins modern capitalist economies to a significant degree. And many of the most successful private companies, so-called, owe their success to corporate welfare. And for those who don't know what that means, we're talking about just the transfer of public monies, of public funds and benefits to corporate actors, you know, without any kind of conditions attached. Here's loads of money, lads. Knock yourselves out. Make profits. Enjoy yourselves. Bung a few quid back to us in donations to our party and maybe give me a directorship whenever I resign, as you mentioned, John Major did, and you can get a job in the arms industry. Does corporate welfare and subsidy and tax breaks feature then heavily, Stuart, in the relationship between state and arms industry?
Oh, my God, yeah, it's absolutely fucking massive, to be honest, bro. And sorry, before I go on to this, just to get back to what Sean said there, the classic case of the intimate connection and the direction of policy by the arms industry was, of course, the Iraq War with fucking Cheney, who pursued that war in the interests of Halliburton. He was their representative in the government. Mm. So that was the classic and the most probably most recent catastrophic case. You also have situations like there was an Israeli general who was sacked for incompetence, probably didn't kill enough people in Lebanon, and he formed his own company, as many Israelis do, and he got in touch with the Georgians before that 2008 conflict with the Russians and said, well, if you buy all these Israeli arms, you've got a chance of actually winning this war. So, yeah, there is an interest for them to go ahead and pursue the conflict. Sorry, getting back on the corporate welfare. Now, a report by Commonwealth a few years ago suggested that long-term purchase orders and direct subsidies, basically long-term purchase orders, you tell the guys, we're going to buy all this no matter what. And obviously direct subsidies, that paid for more than 90% of private sector defence firms' research and development budgets. And that allowed them to give billions of pounds to the shareholders. BAE paid just 14% of its own R&D costs. Yeah, another company called KinetiQ, which is another relatively small but quite important UK private arms manufacturer, pays just 4.5% of its R&D. Now, this is significant. That's a hell of a lot of money you guys have to spend on R&D.
What's the excuse for that, Stuart? What does the state say? Does the state say, well, this is because of national security? This benefits us because we're getting the benefit of this for our own national security. I mean, because it just looks like a handover of wealth, doesn't it, to the private sector? I mean, if they were making washing machines or cars or fucking Hoovers, they wouldn't get away with paying 96% of someone's R&D, would they?
Well, if you read that book by Mazzucato, The Entrepreneurial State, he does this very, very good book I recommend everyone to read. He talks there about the fact that quite a significant part of British R&D is actually financed by the state. But in defence, of course, it will be all down to the same as it is in pharmaceuticals about this whole thing about the uncertainty. So if we don't give these guys the money for essential R&D, they won't do it and we fall behind. Again, it gets down to the power of the lobby to put across a relatively specious argument and to get people to buy into it. It does happen elsewhere, particularly in pharmaceuticals, but I guess they can say pharmaceuticals is an essential industry, so you can probably understand the reasons behind it. With defence, they've managed to convince people, as we discussed before, that this is an essential industry, and if we don't do this, we'll all get gubbed by the Russians. A country with a GDP the size of Italy and shrinking.
Yeah, it's incredible. The propaganda is hard to take at the moment. Sean, what about it? Corporate welfare is a crucial part of this, isn't it? The closest of the link between the state and these arms firms. I mean, they wouldn't survive without the state, basically, would they?
Yeah, no, it's clear that the state is a real crutch for the arms industry, like not just in terms of contracts. You know, you think of the proportion of the military budget that is spent on contracts to those companies, but also is corporate welfare, as Stuart's pointed out. The wider sector plays a massive role as well in the private financial sector. So just as the fossil fuel industry couldn't function without access to cheap credit and a constant flow of equity investment, I was looking at it, the conservative estimate is that the financial sector invested $1 trillion in the arms industry between 2020 and 2022 alone. And that's likely to be much higher due to the lack of transparency and the secrecy involved. So this includes loans provided by traditional banks who charge like massive premiums to arms companies in exchange for those loans. But the majority is made up of shares that have been bought in arms companies by like a wide range of financial institutions. So banks, insurance companies, sovereign wealth funds, pension funds, right? And then the big asset managers. So Stuart's mentioned a few of them there. The three big players, Vanguard, State Street, and BlackRock, have $227 billion invested in the arms industry between them. That's just the three of them.
So it's safer to speak of the military-industrial finance complex, actually. That's how the thing works nowadays, isn't it? I suppose it's the entire edifice of modern capitalism and imperialism that's engaged in increasing the size of the arms trade, but also then the result of that is going to be increased conflict as well. But also, as you said, a lack of investment in all the other things that we need for a decent life and for a transition away from fossil fuels. I want to move on from that one, Stuart. Last big question really is one of the kind of interesting and notorious aspects really of the arms trade, and that's bribes and corruption. I read an article recently that suggested something in the reason that corruption in the arms trade contributes upwards of 40% of all corruption in global transactions. Like it's right in the heart of fucking all corruption that exists on the planet. Now, because of its link to that, made the point already, because of its link to national security, it means there's little oversight and there's no accountability and the kind of no one really knows what's going on behind those closed doors. And it means that there's kind of a small coterie of brokers and dealers, like, was it Margaret Thatcher's son? What was his name? Mark Thatcher. He was heavily involved in that stuff back in the 90s, remember? And so they have this small coterie of people that do these deals. But it's massive, isn't it, corruption in the arms trade?
Oh, my God, yeah. It's a fundamental part of the trade. I mean, the Al-Yamama deal was the one that Mark Thatcher was involved in, even though he denies it. And it became known as the Hoosier Mama deal because his relationship with Thatcher obviously helped it. He still denies he got anything to do with that. But this is a fundamental part of the business. I mean, it's not unknown in other aspects of international trade. I think that we probably neglect to a certain extent how much in Britain, my God, we have our problems, but we are a relatively uncorrupt country compared to many. There was a 1965 report by an industrialist called Donald Stokes that a couple of Guardian journalists got a hold of, and that precipitated the whole investigation into British aerospace. And they were quite shocked by two things that Stokes said in quite a kind of unemotional matter-of-fact sort of way. One, that a lot of the arms that were sold, and this is an important point, a lot of the arms that were sold weren't necessary, but they gave inducements to the buyers through bribes. Yeah, you go ahead and buy this stuff from us. We'll make sure we look after you. So that's actually planting the idea of demand in there with the bribe. And that's a very important part of the way they work. And the fact that he was, Stokes was quite accepting of that's how the business worked, and that it's better done through various intermediaries and so on than it is done through government officials. So it's an accepted part of the business. And yeah, when you look at how it works for people, Christ, whenever British Aerospace were accused of this, the British government defended them to the hilt. They actually put pressure on the SFO to take away the charges completely because it would jeopardize the business, the jobs argument, the security mm-hmm. argument, et cetera. So yeah, fundamental part of the business. We haven't really talked about the middlemen, the arms dealers, many of whom are Israeli and are a very fundamental part of the business. And again, inducements, bribery, et cetera, is a fundamental part of what they do. And they have a funny relationship with the state because sometimes the states that sell arms will use the middlemen unofficially to do the stuff that the state doesn't want to do, and also for intelligence, etc. So it is a very murky, shadowy world.
Yeah. I do remember an article a mate of ours shared with us once, Sean, before you come in there, and it was an article in the FT, and the headline was, peace in Syria will mean I'm going to be left with 1 million Kalashnikovs. What am I expected to do with these guns now? And there was an article in the FT supporting this man complaining and moaning about the fact he was going to be left with all these arms. He had nowhere to flood them. And they were going, God love this player. And my mate was presenting this at a meeting down in Limerick. And from the back of the room, you just heard this voice saying, "There's always a market for AKs." And Sean knows who that was. But moving on swiftly, Sean, the corruption and bribery, it's just... is that when you do read into it, if you just Google corruption and bribery in the arms trade, the stories are fucking hilarious about what they get away with and what's expected when you do a deal with any of these top 5, 6, or 7 arms exporters.
Yeah, I came across some absolute gems. Like one of them, apparently corruption happens on a bigger scale where it involves British and European arms dealers because there isn't the demand for their shitty weapons as there is for those produced in America and Israel. There's a good book on this, and Stuart's aware of it. It's called The Shadow World by Andrew Feinstein, you know, the former ANC MP who's standing against Starmer in his constituency. There's a documentary by the same name, The Shadow World. It's really good. And it's a BAE featured heavily in the book, not surprisingly, because it's been implicated in a whole series of scandals over the past 30 years. So you can imagine how prevalent it is, you know, if they're just talking about scandals involving one company there. But one of the great things about his book, and Stuart's alluded to this, is that he uncovers the role of these brokers, these middlemen who receive a cut from making the deals happen. And one of the gems in the book, he meets with one of these brokers who tells him that often when you're dealing with Saudi Arabia, contracts to sell arms to Saudi Arabia, oftentimes half of the sale price gets returned to the Saudis as a bribe, right? So I thought that was a cracker. But, you know, there's money being made at every stage of this process. Yeah, and that's not only helping to drive the supply of arms, but it's fueling and sustaining conflict.
Yeah, there's a couple of subjects there I want to come back to on another podcast, lads, because I tell you what, I would love to delve a bit more deeply into that murky world of the actual arms dealers and the middlemen, Stuart, that you mentioned, because that is really fascinating. Yeah, I think we'll come back to that. And there's also questions as well we're not going to get time to talk about today, which are worth addressing, which is the environmental impact of the arms trade from extraction right the way through the supply chain to disposal of weaponry at the other end, and of course to conflict itself and the damage that conflict does to the environment. There's a couple of things I wanted to, and we'll come back and talk about. I think a discussion about the middlemen and the brokers will be really interesting, the actual arms dealers themselves, and of course the role of Israel in the middle of all of that. Any last points you want to make there, lads, before I close this excellent and interesting? I've really enjoyed it, by the way. It's been really interesting. Any last points you want to make about the arms trade and why we should be concerned about it in 2024?
I just want to make the point that you will hear people tell you, and again, there is something to be said for this, that our modern world of communication, etc., many of the things that make this conversation possible and make modern life possible derive from research into the arms industry. And there is some truth in this. There is actually a very good book about this, which I talk about again in the article. Book is excellent, really explains how things like advanced eye surgery, the internet, etc., derives from expenditure into the military, much of it, of course, subsidized and indeed paid for by the government. But the fact is, it's inevitable that will be the case because so much money has been channeled into that area of research. If we channeled it into something which was more directly useful, like saving people and actually saving the fucking environment rather than killing people, then we would do a whole lot better. So that argument that we get a hell of a lot of benefit from military research there's something to it, but we could get a lot more benefits some other way. I think Havelock Ellis said something like, all the benefits, all the good things we get from war, we could get from some other direction, we could get some other way.
No, I like that. Thanks for that contribution. Sean, I'll leave you with the last words, mate.
Yeah, and just to reiterate that I think that's an argument we need to get better at making within our own circles, because there is an acceptance on the left and within the trade union movement of the perceived indispensable role that defence industry and militarisation plays in the economy and in job creation and sustaining jobs. So that's something, you know, we need to do a lot more to combat. But I think, you know, I just agree that the impact on the environment is one of the things that would be worth discussing, like, because there's no aspect of climate or ecology that isn't affected by militarisation. So that'd be a really important one to return to.
Definitely will return to that. And also a shout out on this small podcast to all of those people across the North and certainly in Britain and Europe who are protesting arms factories that are sending shipments of arms to aid Israel's genocide in Gaza. Shout out to those punters who are doing great work in protesting the Elbit systems and all those other places. So, lads, thanks very much for that. I really enjoyed that brief dip into the arms trade. I think we'll come back to that when I look at, because another, what I should have said just earlier on, but there's a huge debate there about small arms as well and the damage that the millions of small arms being flooded into Central America, Latin America, Caribbean, and the damage it's doing to society across those areas too, that we might delve into. Because that's part of the arms trade too. It's not all nuclear weapons and tanks. It's guns and it's small arms.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, can I just say, this is a fucking huge issue right now. When you look at what's happening in certain Latin American countries, which have previously managed to avoid being caught up in the drugs industry, Uruguay, Ecuador, they're getting fucked now because there's such a high European demand for cocaine. The bad guys are having to take over ports in Ecuador and also in Montevideo in Uruguay. And you have the mayor of Rotterdam who's warning that the Netherlands could become effectively a narco state. Because some of these guys in the gangs, they are extremely well armed. And a hell of a lot of those arms come from Ukraine and from Eastern Europe and will be provided by Israeli agents.
Right, so we're going to be doing a podcast on small arms, Ukraine, Israeli agents, and the flooding of small arms into Latin and Central America. Lads, thanks very much for your contribution today. Check out, everyone who's listening, the other podcasts on the Left Block platform, leftblock.ie, which is North, Nul na Nog, The Week at Work, and of course, the ABCs of Green Politics. And we'll see you all very soon. Slango foil. That, comrades, was Trademark Belfast. Thanks so much for listening in. We'll see you soon, either in the trenches or on the victory parade. Up the workers, and slango foil.